from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, it's Political Breakdown. Hey, everybody, I'm Scott Schaefer, KQED's politics editor.
I'm Marisa Lagos with KQED's politics team. And today on The Breakdown, we sit down with Alameda public defender Brendan Woods.
But we begin with Facebook. That's right, the company has been a little bit under siege, I would say, since reports surfaced that first 50 and now they say as many as 87 million users have had their personal information taken by the political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica. And of course, they used it to help sway voters toward Donald Trump, among other things. And NPR's tech reporter Aarti Shahani went to Facebook today with Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep.
And we have her here with us.
Hey, Aarti.
Hey, how are you doing?
Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So you went down to Menlo Park and interviewed the COO, Sheryl Sandberg.
That's right. We were down there and we spoke with her today. And she looked a little tired. I've met her on other occasions and it looks like she's, you know, at this point doing a lot of talking.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's been making the rounds. I mean, tell us if this is sort of typical, because to me, as someone who doesn't cover tech, it feels a little bit like the script that a lot of these companies follow, right? A big story breaks, they kind of hunker down, they eventually make the media rounds, and they seem to be pretty sticking to the script and the talking points. Was that your experience today?
I would say yes and no. So, like, just to sort of points that really stuck out to me. I kind of felt like I was in a movie theater watching kind of like something unfurl, right? like I could have had popcorn. But like in some ways she stuck to the script, but in ways that were actually telling. Okay, so for example, at some point Steve Inskeep had asked if Facebook is just too powerful. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there is this latest scandal around Cambridge Analytica and user data. There have been other scandals. Interestingly enough, each scandal is often quite different, raising different issues that we're having with this very powerful company. And when he asked, is Facebook just too powerful? You know, she basically didn't say yes or no. Mm-hmm. She's like, this is a discussion we have. We talk with regulators. And ask him, you know, do you think Facebook is too powerful? She wouldn't say yes or no, but that's, you know, among a lot of informed people that are looking at the company right now, that is actually the question on the table. I mean, you're looking at a company that owns not just this huge social network, Facebook, but also WhatsApp, also Instagram. It's made other acquisitions, and it's fiercely fought off competition, not just through the open marketplace, but through litigation. So, you know, there's so much for regulators to look at above and beyond just what Cambridge Analytica and that scandal raises. And, you know, often what happens is a crisis moment happens, a scandal happens, and then that becomes a teachable moment for people to start paying more attention. And I think that part of what they're concerned about is a little too much teaching and learning going on, and they want this to kind of get over quickly, you know?
Yeah, totally. I know another thing that Steve asked about was another thing that I think a lot of us have been sort of pondering ourselves, which is their business model part of the problem, right? Like, if we're not paying for Facebook, are we, as the consumer, sort of, you know, getting the raw end of the deal there? And we have a cut from her response to that question we want to play.
We know that we did not do enough to protect people's data. I'm really sorry for that. Mark's really sorry for that. And what we're doing now is taking really firm action. Starting Monday, we're going to start rolling out to everyone in the world, right on the top of their newsfeed, a place where you can see all the apps you've shared your data with and a really easy way to delete them. We're being much more restrictive in the data apps are going to have access to. And just yesterday, we announced further steps, shutting down data access points in groups and events and pages and search.
So are the, I mean, it sounds like these are some specific things. Do you feel like this is a good step for them to take or too little too late?
I think it's really interesting how she framed it. You know, we didn't do enough. So in this context, they didn't do enough. There's all this stuff they're now announcing they're going to do. Then in another context, she has this talking point about how Facebook is getting out ahead of regulation, for example, with political advertising and preparing for the midterms. And there's no need for this Honest Ads Act, or she didn't say no need, but, you know, the Honest Ads Act is one on the table to regulate, but Facebook is getting out ahead. And so I think what's interesting is that the latest scandal illustrates how they were far, far, far behind on protecting user privacy, but they want to make it look as though they're racing so quickly lawmakers don't need to pass something, you know? And so that kind of struck me in the conversation today as I was hearing it.
Yeah, and of course, you cover these companies, Facebook and others, Arthi, all the time. And in fact, I remember, I think it was last week, you were reporting from the parking lot at Facebook. Yeah, they wouldn't let you in. Is that more typical than what happened today? I mean, how unusual is this?
I go glamorous. What can I say?
The life of a reporter, so glam.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had gone to the parking, or I actually didn't go to the parking lot. I went to the building. It's Building 20 where they do their interviews. I'd shown up there because it was actually more than a week ago, you know, it just wasn't clear what Facebook's strategy was going to be and how quickly they were going to start speaking out, not to the employees inside that company and certainly not to the reporters outside. And so, you know, that morning it just made sense for me. It was a Monday to just go ahead and see, all right, are they going to give any leadership? And it was interesting because I'd spent a couple of hours there. And they didn't say, no, we're declining this interview. They had me sit down and they were in constant back and forth email communication trying to figure out what to do. So I thought that was such a telling moment about, you know, they are conflicted about how much to speak and not to speak. Because one thing that is different between, for example, a Facebook and an ExxonMobil is Facebook is a social network. Mark Zuckerberg has a page where he posts things and he has like fans and followers and people that heart and laugh and like and comment. And so they have to project an image of deeper engagement than, you know, your average CEO would.
Do you think they get the irony of the fact that they are, you know, so difficult sometimes to penetrate for journalists? You know, here they are all about sharing and openness, and yet they're pretty closed off to, at least to journalists.
Oh, I'm certain that they get, you know, not just the irony, but perhaps the unsustainability of it. I think that they're trying to figure out how to start to engage in a bit more sort of adult and richer way with the press corps that is following them and reporting on them. Because, you know, for years, they didn't really know how to do that. And that's, I think, a little bit more typical of a Silicon Valley startup. There's not sort of the norms around transparency. But, you know, particularly as more of the implications of the work get political for them, they have to deal with that kind of engagement.
Yeah, so we know Mark Zuckerberg is expected to testify before Congress next week. You mentioned some federal legislation. There's a ballot measure around privacy and the California ballot that's trying to get qualified that I think they're already pouring money into opposing. I mean, what do you expect? You know, what should we look for in the public quickly before we let you go and enjoy your evening?
I'm looking for lawmakers to ask fundamentals. Okay, so it's interesting that, you know, there's legislation around political advertising. But the huge issues on the table are, you know, antitrust and sort of power issues about how much power Facebook has amassed. And the other issue, obviously, is privacy. Right now, the default setting for us is effectively go ahead and data mine, you know, the users. What if the default setting were to change so that I have to opt into it, not opt out of it? So I want to see how fundamental lawmakers go.
All right. Well, and of course, you can hear more of Steve Inskeep's interview with Facebook's COO, Sheryl Sandberg, tomorrow on Morning Edition, right here on KQED. Arthi Shahani, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we're going to be joined by the guy whose office defends low-income people accused of crimes in Alameda County, the public defender, Brendan Woods. You're listening to Political Breakdown.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here along with Scott Schaefer. And also joining us is someone you may not have heard from before. This is our Alameda public defender, Brendan Woods. He oversees about 100 attorneys who handle tens of thousands of cases every year. Welcome to the breakdown.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, we want to get into, I know you've made a lot of changes in the office since you became public defender, but one thing we like to do on this show is get a sense of why people do the work they do. And in our reading, I know you're a gaucho, so go gauchos. I graduated from UC Santa Barbara, too. But it sounds like you, some of what drove you to become a defense attorney really came from your personal experience growing up as a Black man in America and sort of the family experiences you had. Can you just talk a little bit about, like, why are you doing this work?
Sure. I think we all come to this work for different reasons. For me, it was kind of a personal story, where I'm from, where what I saw growing up as a kid, and those things that have impacted my life and impacted my family. So I guess to start out, just kind of going way back.
Yeah, go way back.
Go way, way back.
All the way, man. Where were you
born? I was born at some point in time.
Yeah.
No, but seriously, I was born, and I'm a family of immigrants. I was the first one in my family born in the States on my mom's side. We're from Jamaica, Queens. So when you come over from Jamaica, Queens, you go to Jamaica, Queens, New York. That's where
right.
I was born.
Okay.
And, you know, we were fairly low income, and we struggled. And I've seen that struggle, and I've seen how it affects my family. And I've had several members of my family been impacted by the system. Now, for example, I have an uncle who was released about a year and a half ago from serving 27 years in prison for bank robbery.
Wow.
I have another cousin. It's a real long time. And from looking at his trial transcript, just seeing, you know, it always sticks with me. I wonder how his case would have changed if he had a really good lawyer, mm-hmm. someone who's competent, who's someone who's really cared about him. And then seeing how it's impacted my cousins, who one who was beaten pretty badly when he was younger by the police in New York, and then his life changed drastically from that, and he began to commit crimes, and he was on federal parole. You know, another cousin who was also impacted with mental health issues and began to self-medicate with marijuana, then meth, then crack, and he ended up committing those same sort of crimes and petty thefts and robberies. So I've seen how this criminal justice system, or some call it injustice system, kind of preys on communities of colors, and how if proper resources aren't given to them, they end up in this system.
Mm-hmm.
And when we think about what we do as a society, we need to think about this in the name of public safety. We take human beings and we place them in cages, and we do this in mass. We do it in phenomenally shocking numbers. And so I see my role as a public defender in multiple arenas. Number one, trying to make sure all of the people I represent are treated like people, they're treated like human beings, and we fight for them and advocate for them. We don't treat them like they are defendants or PFN numbers or file numbers. And then we push back hard against the system of mass incarceration that's just removing low-income people of color and placing them in jails and prisons. So that's really what got me to this work, and why I do this work, and why I'm, if you can't tell, why I'm so
passionate
about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, and I'll say, I love my job. I love what I do. I've been doing it for 21 years now, I think, 22 years now. And I love it. I don't plan on doing anything else.
Do you, you meet people when they've gotten into the system. They've been charged with something, or they've been arrested. But when you think about that system you just described with its racial biases, like what's the root of it, do you think, as it relates to the criminal justice system? Where does it begin?
The root of it, I think, begins in a institution that is steeped in racism. If we go back, that's how it begins. And I think the best...
But I mean, let me just break...
Sure.
So, I mean, the people in the system all grow up in the same, you know, they grow up in the community, and then they get into the system. But is there something before they get there? Do they bring something to the system, do you think?
I think the system brings it to them. I think the system brings it to them. The system, or maybe we as a society don't bring enough resources to the communities. So instead, we spend millions and millions of dollars on incarceration or policing or probation, as opposed to money that can go to education and jobs and housing. So it is us refocusing our priorities with regards to how we want to define public safety. And the way we do it right now is absolutely wrong.
Well, I know you, even though, I mean, you know, you basically grew up, I think, with a single mom, but she joined the military. You guys, you know, you were not... You moved around. You lived in Carmel. I know you experienced a lot of racism yourself, and some interactions with the law enforcement system that seemed to have colored that. I mean, give us some examples. Like, what kind of things were you experiencing? Because from the stories I've heard, they were very like, it wasn't like, oh, I was causing trouble and then something happened. It was like, I got pulled over because I was Black.
Yeah. I mean, so that's a reality of being a Black man in America.
Right.
You get stopped frequently just by the color of your skin. And when I was younger, I'm still now. I think I was pulled over 3 weeks ago, last time.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Where?
On Fulton Avenue.
In San Francisco.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was pulled over frequently. I think when I was in high school, it was about once every other month I got stopped.
Wow.
There was an instance where I was followed back to my high school by the police. They knew who I was, and there wasn't any question with regards to me doing illegal activity. It was just kind of embarrassing, shaming in front of my friends. Now, there's one instance where I got stopped driving back from kind of a longer story, but I was in college, and my friend's car broke down. And I drove up to pick them up, and I was rushing to get them down to UCLA. I was going to UC Santa Barbara at the time, and I was driving quickly to get them down there so I could drop them off and get back to UC Santa Barbara because I had a final next day. So I was just I was in a hurry. I was speeding. Yes, I was guilty of speeding. I had a little black Nissan Sentra, and the speedometer was pegged. It went to 85, and it was pegged. I was speeding. And so I got pulled over by police in Ventura, and it was one cop car arrived, then another cop car arrived, and then another cop car arrived. This was not your normal speeding ticket. I was pulled out. I was placed on the side of the road. And, you know, the questions then began to go to my friends who were in the car. There were three of them. They were all white. You know, are you guys okay? Are you safe? Where was he taking you?
Oh, wow.
And so that whole dynamic.
Like, you're like a middle-class college student.
I'm a college kid. Yeah. I am a college kid. And I'm thinking, what the hell is happening here? And so there were instances like that happened repeatedly. And it made me think in that moment, I felt completely powerless. And I'm going to do everything in my power to have power to change that system.
So I know one of the things, like, you've done in your office is a sort of Know Your Rights program.
Sure.
to talk to kids, especially of color, I assume. And you have, you know, two kids of your own. Like, what kind of things are you trying to impart on young people? Because those are the situations that can escalate and end up poorly for everybody, obviously, even if it is an unjustified stop.
Yeah, so one of our programs we have, you mentioned, is a Know Your Rights program called LYRIC, which stands for Learn Your Rights in California. And part of the genesis of that is from my experience as a young black man. And so we go out to high schools, mostly in Oakland Unified School District in Alameda County, and we've taught over 4,000 kids so far about what their rights are when they come in contact with the police. You know, these are your rights. If you want to assert them, this is how you do it, and this is how you do it safely. So we try to empower our youth with knowledge that will keep them out of the system.
You've worked in the public defender, as you said, for more than 20 years, and the Oakland Police Department has undergone some real rough years in there with the whole...
You could say that.
You could say that, riders and all that. And we had actually John Burris on the show last week talking about that. But, you know, how right now the way things are in Oakland, do you feel like there's a decent working relationship between your office and the police, or still work to be done?
I would never say that my relationship or our relationship is a decent working relationship. I would never describe it as working together. We can...
Because it's adversarial.
It's adversarial. Yeah, we don't work
not like
together.
The DA.
Yeah.
Not like that.
We just don't work together. We may have an issue that comes up. We had one recently with regards to them not granting U visas or denying U visas, and we had an issue we raised with them, and they corrected themselves. So we have that sort of working relationship. But we are definitely... They are on one side of the law and we're on the other.
I guess what I'm thinking about is the kind of programs that Maurice asked you about, like where you're out there telling youth and young
yes.
people about their rights and how to stay on the right side of the law and do it responsibly. I mean, do you get a sense that the police department finds that to be, you know, threatening in some way, or is it
not really
on their radar?
I don't think they do, but they shouldn't, because all we're doing is telling youth what their rights are and how they can protect themselves in some ways from the police. So the role of the public defender is to advocate for our clients and to also hold those in power, such as police and judges and prosecutors, accountable. And that's our job.
So let's talk a little bit more about your job and how and the dynamic, because you know, sitting in San Francisco, we have the only elected public defender in the state. You, from the beginning of your tenure as leading your office, have really put yourself out there as being more outspoken and advocating not just on individual cases but on policies and bigger issues. So I guess I'm curious, has that been a good thing? I mean, I think that there's this sense that DAs are elected, so they maybe have more latitude to speak out, and that public defenders have been worried about keeping their jobs historically.
I think that's the case in some locations. I think I'm fortunate to be in Alameda County, which is a more liberal jurisdiction, and we're able to push the envelope more. Now, part of a job of a public defender, as a chief public defender, as a line deputy, is to be a voice for our clients. And in my position, I think I can be a louder voice, and I'm taking advantage of that.
You were the first African-American public defender in Alameda County. Did you feel any particular responsibility because of that, or obligation or pressure?
I don't think I felt pressure. I think it was important. And if you think about your statement right there, I was appointed in 2012, the first African-American in Alameda County. And you think of Alameda County being a real liberal part of the state, the Bay Area, probably the most liberal part of the nation. And it wasn't until 2012 that an African-American held that position. And considering the population we serve, that's atrocious.
And it's also one of the oldest public defender offices.
Formed
right?
in 1927.
1927.
Now I'm going to blow your mind. Now I'm going to blow your mind. As of April 1st, I believe that I am the only chief public defender who's black in the state of California.
Wow.
Wow. You know, one thing that Jerry Brown has done is appoint more public defenders to the bench.
Yes.
You know, governors wouldn't, I don't think any other governors really did it, certainly not to the extent that he's doing it. They would appoint district attorneys and prosecutors and all that. What difference do you think that makes?
It makes a huge difference.
Are you seeing it?
Yeah. So we've had a couple of people from my office appointed recently.
Yeah.
And it makes a difference when you have someone who can come to that position and who can really, I guess, see both sides and can see our clients as people. And that's a critical part of the job, as opposed to just being and holding that one law enforcement lens.
We're talking with Alameda County Public Defender Brendan Woods. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer here with Marisa Lagos. A lot of people, I think, look at defense attorneys generally, but public defenders in particular, as having to defend people that they know are guilty of something. Might not be what they were charged with, but do you feel that way, or do you compassion earlier? How do you feel about the folks that you want to get them a fair trial? Of course, you want to get them justice, whatever that is in that case. But have you ever, say, won a case and got someone acquitted and felt like, you know, that person really maybe shouldn't be out on the street?
No, I've never felt that way. That's never come into my mind. And to provide some context, I think we should really think about the people my office represents and the people public defenders' offices represent statewide. They are all low income. If we're talking about justice, really talking about justice, and we step back, economics should play no part in the way justice is administered. Mm-hmm. So if you have someone who's got a ton of money, they can go out and hire the most expensive lawyer, the most well-paid lawyer ever, who's going to fight for them tooth and nail. Are they going to say, well, I can't take your money and represent you if you're guilty? No, they're not going to do that. They're going to fight for them. So why should justice be any different for my poor, low-income black clients from East Oakland? It shouldn't matter. So we as public defenders need to fight tooth and nail for every single client.
Do you think, kind of back to the question about judges, like when you walk in a courtroom, or I know you're not necessarily trying cases anymore, but I mean, my sense, you know, there's supposed to be this adversarial system between the DA and the public defender or the defense attorney, and then you have a judge. But often, you know, judges are people too, right? They often have preconceived notions and ideas about the client before them or those sorts of things. I mean, how much do you feel like of the job of your staff is trying to sort of overcome assumptions that might be made before you guys even get to the courtroom?
That occurs every day, all day.
Wow.
It really does. We are always trying to push back against stereotypes, push back against preconceived notions, and to get people to really see our clients as human beings. And that's a big part of our job.
So a lot of, I mentioned that you have engaged your office in sort of more policy and legislative advocacy. One of the big issues before the legislature this year is bail reform, and it's something we're hearing a lot about nationally. I'm just curious, like, how optimistic are you that something could change in California?
Oh boy, I am hopeful. I'm really, really hopeful. I may have been more hopeful last year than this year, but I'm still hopeful. And bail reform is something that needs to happen. Because every day right now, if you're a public defender, if you go into the criminal courts, you see people who are in custody every day solely because they can't afford to bail out. Every day in courts, people are taking deals, plea bargains, to get out of custody. Nothing to do with guilt or innocence. I want to take a deal so I can go home and be with my family. That happens every single day, and that's not justice.
We have a few minutes left, and you're obviously a very passionate guy, very intense guy. What do you do for fun?
I work. What do you mean? I love my job.
That's what I was wondering.
Fun, you know.
And your wife's a lawyer, too. Like, I feel like you guys, do you guys just, like, read case files together?
We don't do that. I've got two kids. I love going to the sporting events. My daughter... One's a big soccer player. The one's a volleyball, basketball player, I think. So I got two sporting events this weekend. I'll be sports all weekend. So you keep
it real in some ways. That's not
I
all
watch,
work.
I watch SportsCenter while I do work.
Is it hard to get away from the work?
I don't want to get away from the work.
Even on the weekends?
No. I mean, no, I'm sorry. No, I take a break. I do. But I really enjoy this job. It is an absolute privilege to represent and work with the clients I do. It's a privilege to lead the attorneys in my office. I mean, I love what I do.
Hmm. Do you think, could you see yourself being on the bench one day?
No.
Well, that was fast.
No, because if you are a judge, you are supposed to be a neutral arbitrator. Hmm. I'm an advocate. And that's all I want to do. I went to law school to advocate.
But isn't that the point of having a diverse bench, is that you have different judges have different experiences and different points of view?
Four public defenders who are challenging judges in San Francisco this year.
Yes, and God bless them. I hope they win.
Your wife's not one of them.
No, she's not. No. It's great. It's right for some people, but it's not right for me.
Yeah. Do you think, one of the things these public defenders have said is that, you know, we're challenging people who are appointed by Republicans. They don't reflect the city. But some of them are Democrats, some of the sitting judges, some of them are women, some of them are people of color. Is that a hard case to make, do you think, to the public? Or do people even pay attention to this?
I don't think enough people pay attention to it, honestly. I don't think enough people pay attention to those judges that are making decisions and that are impacting people's lives.
And then just quickly, you mentioned you have a couple daughters. Either of them, do you think, going to go into the law?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Whether they know it or not.
They're going to be public defenders. Come on, really?
I hope you're listening, girls. Your future has just been decided.
It was decided a long time ago.
All right. Brandon Woods, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
me. Appreciate it. And that does it for this edition of Political Breakdown. If you like what you heard or heard enough to want more, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts.
Katie Orr is our Sacramento reporter. Our producer tonight is Jeremy Siegel because Guy Marzorati is gallivanting around Ireland.
Wait, I thought he was in Dublin, Alameda County.
No. That's what I thought too, but apparently it's a better
Ireland vacation.
Our engineer is Seal Muller. Ethan Lindsay is our managing editor. And Holly Kernan is our vice president of news.
I'm Scott Schaefer. You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Scott Schaefer. And she's Marisa Lagos.
I am Marisa Lagos.
How do we follow you, Marisa?
It's at M. Lagos.
Okay, good. And that is a wrap
That'll
for this week's Political Breakdown from KQED. We'll see you next time.